Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. A great show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. And on YouTube, I'm at Arroyo Grande Show. He's a comic actor, a master impressionist, star of numerous classic comedies, not to mention an early 80s cast member on Saturday Night Live. He's also the author of a new memoir packed with behind-the-scenes stories about his incredible life in showbiz so far. It's called Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer. Here's my exclusive interview with the vice chairman of the board, my pal, Joe Piscopo. Joe, thank you for being here. I'm delighted. You're going to tell that story later about why I called you vice chairman of the board. But tell us how you got into this business, Joe, and who your first inspirations are. I thought it would be Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or somebody, but it wasn't.
Yeah, very close. And Raymond, honored to be with you always. Sure. Really, really always an honor to be with you, dear friend. And thanks for reading the book. I appreciate that very much. But, you know, the funny thing is, when I was a kid in Bloomfield, New Jersey, and we'd be watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and I just could distinctly remember, third grade maybe I was, and there was a guy, and this is really esoteric.
Okay.
So stay with me if you would. There was a guy named Guy Marks, and he was a comedian out of Philadelphia. And he would do like bits. And also a guy named Frank Gorshin. These guys would do bits. They would set stages and say, what happens if this guy, if Humphrey Bogart, walks into a bar? I was mesmerized by that. Jerry Lewis was always my icon, and you doing the greatest Jerry Lewis interview ever. You know, that's show business legend. We all know that. So Jerry was like a hero to me watching The Nutty Professor back then.
Yeah.
But these guys and Ed Sullivan doing characterizations, that caught my eye. Not the Alan Kings, not the Milton Berles, not the stand-ups, the guys that would just do characterization. Isn't that funny? I got sucked right into that.
Yeah, and they were kind of impressed. I mean, Frank Gorshin was a renowned impressionist. Of course, people know him from the Riddler on the old Batman show, but he was much more than that if you've ever seen his act, you know. But you say you weren't a comic, Joe Piscopo, but why were you in comedy class?
Yeah. Well, just to get a platform to become a working actor. So when I went and I got out of college, and my father, God bless him, rest his soul, was an attorney, and I knew I should have gone to law school. He could have probably got me into law school, and I would have been with him in Jersey representing, you know, the blue collar workers like Pop did. And I said, let me try the comedy thing, because Ray, I didn't want to like get to an age and say, geez, I wonder what would have happened if I ever did that. So I said, I got to go to the comedy clubs. Let me get on stage. They could see me. And then all I wanted to be is what I am now, just a working actor. Are you working? It's about working. It's about the journey. Never wanted to be a star. Never wanted to be a stand-up comic. So I went, I put like 5 minutes together, went to the improvisation, 1976. When New York was really rough. You think it's bad now. It was really rough back then. And the story goes, as I said in the book, it was true. I said, let me try audition night, Sunday nights. And I went in and I went through the Lincoln Tunnel and went around 8th Avenue, came down 9th Avenue, 44th and 9th, the legendary improvisation comedy club. Audition night, there must have been 300, maybe 400 people waiting to get into audition.
400?
And I looked at it had to be. Had to be hundreds of people lined down 9th Avenue. Right. And I looked at that line and I kept going, went right back in the Lincoln Tunnel, and I went back home and chickened out completely, you know?
Tell me how Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller mentored you. You mentioned that in the book.
Oh, the best. I just saw Ben Stiller, and I just told him how Ann and Jerry were such a big influence on me. So after a while, when I went back, we would have to get there at noon to audition. And then at 8 o'clock, I remember everybody, Judy would come out, she'd hand the numbers out, and we'd get on stage. So you do audition after a while. And then Chris Albrecht, as you read in the book, was the guy that made me a regular at the improv. Meant you had to hang out in the dark, dingy bar till 2:30 in the morning and play before like four drug people. That was a regular, you know? But who was in the bar? It was Stiller and Mira. It was Ann and Jerry, and they were there. And they could not have been nicer. They were just so kind to me. And they said, look, you gotta work. And then they said to me, and they said, you gotta do the commercials. I said, I could do commercials? Yes, somebody will come in, they'll see you on stage, you'll be able to do commercials and make money, and that's the money. So if you make money doing commercials, you can really do what you want to do in your career. And they were really influential, could not have been nicer. We were scared. We were all scared back then.
Yeah, of course.
And Ann Amira particularly was so nice. They were sweetheart. They gave me the best advice. You want to do commercials, you'll make money, so you could go like this. You remember this, the Italian thing?
Yeah.
You could do what you want.
Yeah,
and
Larry David was also a comic at the same time and a writer. Was he on SNL when you were there?
He was for a minute. And he was like, let me tell you, back in the late 70s, at the comedy scene, and thank you for bringing it up, Ray. The comedy scene, it was like when comedy became rock and roll.
Right.
It just caught on. I don't know if it was Freddie Prinze Sr., whether it was Rodney, whether it was Robin Williams, Robert Klein. I wonder what, whatever it was a perfect mix of, oh my gosh, comedy is hot. Everybody had to do comedy. And so that's when I went in there, and there was Larry David. Larry David was there. And Larry had been there a couple years prior to when I went in.
Yeah.
So now Larry was, he would go on stage and he would get into fights with the audience. Right. He would get into that back. What you see on Curb Your Enthusiasm, that's Larry, man.
Yeah.
And we would all gather by the little hallway that led to the showroom, the bar to the showroom. Hey, yeah. Larry's on. And you go, Larry, back and forth with the people, fighting with the people. And it was, you know what, though? It was comic genius. You could see it was comic genius, you know? But I've never seen him do a full set because he would always leave in a huff. It was so great to watch. Back then, you know.
He'd leave in a huff. Yeah, look, we have mutual friends.
He would.
And he continues that routine today, Joe. But look, tell me, leaves in a huff. Tell me what you learned when I read in the book about Rodney Dangerfield. He was the first comic I ever saw live. I was 11 years old, and I begged my mother to buy tickets to two of his shows back-to-back in New Orleans. And I sat in the front row. He insulted me for half of it. It was fantastic. What did you learn from Rodney Dangerfield?
Well, Rodney was a sweetheart, and he would come in, and I was the MC at that point.
Right.
And so I'd be on the stage at the Improv, and you could see the shadow of Rodney in the back light, in the back room, and I'll never forget this. And Rodney, I'll tell you, sweetheart, great guy, and blew that room out like nobody else. Rodney killed it. Pryor came into that room. All the greats came into that room. Nobody blew that room out, the improvisation, 44th and 9th, Hell's Kitchen in New York, late 70s, like Rodney. And we would watch him mold his set to go on The Tonight Show. And then we'd be in the bar, you know, on a weeknight, and we'd watch Rodney do his brilliance. So I saw his shadow, and I went, whoa, it's Rodney. So I say, being a kid, I don't know what that, I'm on stage going like, hey, Rodney Dangerfield is here. And the crowd goes nuts. They go nuts. And I go, Rodney, come up on stage. Come on. And like that. I go on stage. There's a pause. There's a little pause. I go, Rodney, come on. Rodney finally comes up, does a killer set. After the set, we go back to the bar, and he says to me, and he comes over. He goes, Joe, you're a good kid. You're a good kid. I like you. You're a good kid. You're okay. You're all right. You're okay. And I'm looking at him. I go, thanks, Rodney. He goes, but you don't introduce me like that. You got to do it with respect. I'll tell you. And he's telling me how to do it with respect, the man who gets no respect at all. You know? Is that wild? So in my mind, like, I love when you're on the air, Raymond Arroyo. You're so polite and you're gracious when you come on our radio show, and when you're doing national television or your 350 million homes that you go into on EWTN. That is such a testament to your character, by the way, if I may. But I learned from Rodney, and to this day, everybody who comes on my radio show, look who's kind enough to join us. Would you be so kind to welcome?
When I read that, I thought, you've never forgotten the lesson. You do it every day, Joe Piscopo, on your radio show. Because, you know, you'll book me for a 10-minute slot on the radio show. 5 minutes is just introduction. So, you know, which I love. Look, it means less work for me. I'm happy. That's why whenever they call, will you do the show? I say, yes, Joe, I'll be with Mr. Piscopo. You bet.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I love it. Look, you get booked on the Merv Griffin show. How big a break was that? And tell people how that led to Saturday Night Live for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, so we're at the club, and then people would. The Tonight Show was one thing. That was the high bar.
Yeah.
And that was Rodney, and that was Robin Williams, and that was everybody, and Pryor, certainly. So now, Merv Griffin had a show, and it was a big show, syndicated all around the country, as you know. Mm-hmm. So now, people were getting picked up on Merv's show, and Merv's people came to me and said, we'd like you to do 5 minutes. So I'm thinking, I'm not a stand-up comic. I'm just up here trying to get a job as an actor, you know, so I can keep working. They said, put together 7 minutes. And then I go, great. They brought me out to L.A., and it was right there in Hollywood. And Merv, a real sweetheart, a great guy, as you know. And it was weird because I was backstage, and then I heard, you know, hey, please welcome new comic from New York, Joe Piscopo. And I came out, and then I remember in the clubs, this is the little things I remember. One of the comics said, look, the cameras are high, the audience is low. If you are low, you're not going to be making contact with the camera. Keep your eyes to the camera, which was great advice. Wow. You see how we used to talk back in the clubs then? It was all a great learning process. So I'm doing my bit, and the audience is laughing, and I want to go into the crowd, but I stayed, and the hit was really good. Now Saturday Night Live is ending its run with Lorne in the original cast, and they're looking for new talent. They sweep all the comedy clubs. They sweep, and you know what? No one gets nothing. Nobody hears anything. Oh, maybe there was a guy named Richie. Maybe Richie got in. Nobody got nothing. So now I had a friend writing with Gene Domanian, who they put in to replace Lorne Michaels, and she needed a utility guy. And my buddy, who was writing, John DeBellis, goes, hey, Joe Piscopo does impressions down at the Improv. Why don't you bring him in? I go up to the 17th floor. I do an audition for Gene. She loves it. She goes, come to the audition when we have everybody in. And now that was an honor, and to be able to do that. I must have bypassed 5,000 people who everybody wanted to replace the original cast. I didn't want to replace the original cast. You couldn't replace the original cast. Yeah. It was Gilda Radner. It was Billy Murray and Chevy Chase, Belushi and Aykroyd. You can't replace that cast. Yeah. So I went back and forth with my agent, with Chris Albrecht. I said, Chris, they want to see you. Don't ask me to do this. I can't do it. So the audition comes. I'm there. Paul Rubens was there. Pee Wee Herman was there. Gilbert Gottfried was there. We were all there auditioning. And there must have been hundreds of people. And you know what? I could care less because I didn't want the job. So I think that's why I got hired. Right. I was so flippant. I did Sinatra. I was calm. And they probably thought, hey, this guy, if he's calm now.
Yeah, he'll be great.
You know, they made the offer, and I still didn't want to do it. But then my agent said, you're doing Saturday Night Live. You got to do it.
Wow.
And we did it. And the first 10 shows weren't easy. I'll tell you, they were tough, you know, the going back and trying to replace the original class. Almost an impossible task, my friend.
But you're paired with so many incredible people. You and Eddie Murphy particularly are the standouts of that second cast. What was the key to that chemistry that you two had, Joe?
Yeah.
Tell me about the timing.
Ray. It's like, you know, I just saw him at the SNL 50, and there's a connection there. But Eddie has that connection. He's a magic kind of person where he has a connection like that with everybody. So, but I remember they called me and they said, we got a young kid from Long Island, and he's a comic, and we want you to read with him. So I went back up to 17th floor. Now, I had been hired at that point. I believe I was hired at that point. And I went up, and there's a kid, young kid, 19 years old from Long Island. Never heard of him. He was, because the Long Island clubs are one thing, Manhattan clubs were something else, you know?
Mm.
And I said, hey, he goes, meet Eddie Murphy. I said, Eddie, how are you? Joe Piscopo. It was like magic right there at that second. Up in the 17th floor, I remember exactly where he was seated. I remember the chairs. I remember the location. And you just connect. Some people you just connect with, and he was one of those. And I think a lot of people will tell you that about Eddie Murphy. But then they had us read. They said, you and Eddie got to read the word association sketch that Richard Pryor and Chevy Chase did, you know, where they went back and forth, very politically incorrect.
Yes.
So now now you got suits in the room, right? You got suits in the room. And you got the producer, and you got the writers, and you got the suits from NBC. And I'm reading the Chevy part, and Eddie's doing Pryor. And Eddie's to my right, and I'm reading it, and he is crushing it. He's crushing it. He's 19. And I felt the energy. I felt how, I said, this kid is like a comic genius. Like, you could just know it. You just knew it. Fluent, not a reckless abandon. And I knew right there. And I said, Eddie, hold on a second. So I went in and talked to Gene Domanian, and there's some NBC executives. And we closed the door. And I said, and I was with my buddy DeBellis, too. And we said, this is the next Pryor. You got to hire this kid. NBC wouldn't do it. They thought he was too edgy. Is that the wildest thing? You know? I said, I know. Teddy was too edgy. So they made him a featured player. So the first Ted show, you will see Eddie in these nondescript sketches. But then he goes, this was the key, if I may, where he goes, I want to do a sketch. I go, what are you thinking, man? And we just, again, the friendship was there. What do you think? I'd go out to Long Island. We would hang out. He goes, I want to do a sketch about a guy who's in the NBA and saying there should be no white people in the NBA. And I went, that's hysterical. Could you make that? So he goes, I go, come on, Weekend Update. I'll do the sports guy. Hello again, everybody. Joe Piscopo live, Saturday Night Sports. And you sit next to me, and Eddie and I work our way in to the Weekend Update desk. We put him on phone books, so he looks taller than I. Crushed it, and the rest, as they say, is history. He just crushed it, and he ran with it.
Tell me about the Sinatra and the Stevie Wonder sketch, an all-time classic.
Like I said many times, you are truly a wonder.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
But where did that originate, Joe?
At a piano upstairs on the 17th floor. And the song came out, Ebony and Ivory, and Eddie and I were at the piano, tinkering around the piano, saying, you know, we should do our version of this. You should do Stevie. I'll do Frank Sinatra. And we turned it over to our key writers, Barry Blaustein and Dave Sheffield. And they wrote it, and we had read-through, and it was, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, Raymond, but it was, to me, my duty doing the Frank Sinatra impression was protecting the Sinatra name. Yeah. I never wanted to be rude. The sketch was a little too edgy for me, so I cleaned it up, and we went and we tried it, and I remember mounting it, and it just felt so comfortable because Eddie would do, he did a killer Stevie Wonder,
hilarious.
Me doing the Frank Sinatra, and you know, I don't know that you would get that through read-through now. You are black and I am white.
Swing it, Stevie, with a bounce, baby. You are black, I am white.
And then the one time I upstaged Eddie Murphy ever, the one time only, you are blind as a bat and I have sight. I was like, oh, my God. It was so over the top, by the grace of God.
And right in character, Joe, right in character. Look, we'll talk about Frank Sinatra in a minute, but let's talk for a moment about being Italian. I know it's very important to you. Your dad, who was a lawyer, had a credo. Tell me what that was and how that Italian family you grew up with really shaped everything that was to come.
Yeah, you know, my grandparents came from another country, as you know, and they worked so hard. They could barely speak the language. And when my father first went to school, he couldn't even speak English, you know. And I got to tell you, I went back to the school at what is now the Roberto Clemente School in Newark to speak with the kids, you know. And I went and I told these kids in a Spanish class, they didn't speak a word of English. I said, well, my father came to the school, he couldn't speak English either, you know. So I'm telling you, so they went. He learned the language. Not only did he learn the language, he went on to skip two grades at that school, and he went on to become an attorney to represent the non-English-speaking blue-collar laborers that his parents were. My grandparents, they would talk. I can't believe what they went through. So I don't know how to describe it. My mom, too. There's no rewards for being parents or coming from another country, learning the language, loving America. My father loved this great country. Everything I do on the radio, it's my parents, you know? But when my mother just passed away last year, rest her soul, you know what? They don't get a plaque. They don't get a trophy. They don't get, like you and I, we always get acknowledged by an organization and we do a speech and we go, thank you. We take the plaque, we put it on our office. Yeah. You get a little plaque. Nothing. My parents, nothing. Yeah. They just did what they wanted to do, onward and forward. My pop served in the United States military. Here's an Italian family that came from Italy. Now, Mussolini's starting the war. Where do they send? My grandparents would say, look, we're Italian. You're not going to fight against the people in the villages. They sent my father as an Italian-American over to Italy to clear the villages where he was brought up of the Nazis that were in there and to put the bombs on the plane of the B-24s and the B-17s so they could bomb the heck out of Berlin. And I'll tell you what, that is a legacy that I will never match.
Tell me your father's credo.
What, onward and forward? Onward and forward like that?
Yeah.
It was just like never say die, always keep going. And the fact that he always, this is my father in a nutshell. It was his funeral. We were about at his funeral. It was the wake. And there was some guy at his coffin as it was laid out. And the guy had, you could see dirt in his fingernails. He has jeans were all dirty. And he looked like he just came off the site, the work site. And I said, can I help you? And he goes, no, I just wanted to pay respects to your dad. And he goes, I got hurt on my truck. And no one got me money. I was down and out. I had nothing. And your father took my case to court, and he won. And I'm here to pay my respects. That's my old man right there.
Wow.
You know what? That's my father. Onward and forward, though. No matter what, you go up or down, in and out, And if you read in the book, I don't want to hold it. I don't want to, go on and on now. But he got shot by some crazy person. He was shot 3 times in the arm, the stomach, and the leg while he was an attorney, And he gets hit. And it was in Passaic, New Jersey in 1961, Ray. And he leans against the building, and all his friends came over to him. And it was just an arbitrary, crazy, shooter. And they said, Joe, are you okay? To my father, Joe, are you okay? What can we do? And my father hands him his briefcase and says, you better cancel all my cases for tomorrow. I don't think I'll be able to make it, like that,
Onward and
great
forward.
Great sense of humor.
Onward
Boom,
and forward.
Like that, man.
Joe, your mother sent you to piano lessons, which led to your first onstage appearance. Tell me about that. Tell me about the first time on stage.
Ray, Mrs. Gimble. And somebody called on my radio show the other day and said, I remember Mrs. Gimble. They were friends with Mrs. Gimble. She was from Glen Ridge, New Jersey. She was my piano teacher. I wanted to play baseball with Johnny Vargo, with Johnny LaBadia, and Kenny Russo. We had a little Rat Pack in sixth grade in Bluefield, New Jersey, I said, I want to play baseball. And Mom said, you're going to take piano lessons. I said, Mom, please, I want to go on. And so I took piano lessons, and Mrs. Gimble, she used to keep time on my shoulder like this, boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. And I learned everything, and then we used to have these recitals, and then where the parents come, at the end of the whole, music season. So we had a recital. We had to do like a Mexican theme. So they had sombreros, and it had like a fake donkey on stage. We went big time back then. So we did our little Mexican thing, whatever it was, and then we went backstage. And then Mrs. Gimble goes, "Oh my gosh!" I go, "What's the matter, Mrs. Gimble? I'm in third grade." She, "What's the matter?" He goes, "We left a donkey out on the stage.
Oh.
We left the donkey." I go, "I don't miss a beat." I go like this. I got it, Mrs. Gimble. I'll go get the donkey like that. So I walk out on stage, and there's a full crowd. And I walk out, I looked at the donkey, it's just me, and I did this on stage. I said, hey, what are you doing? Like that. And I'm third grade with this, Place broke out in immediate laughter. There was my comfort zone. That's where I found out in third grade. This is what I got to do. It's like addictive, kind of.
Yeah.
I felt it. And to this day, the comfort zone is like on camera. The comfort zone is on stage. I think you feel the same way, Mr. Arroyo.
You guys wore ties. I can't believe it.
Yeah. Very hip guys. Hi there. How are you? Nice. I wore a tie to a TV special. How are you?
It's prime time. We like to keep it clean. You know what I mean?
This is a very important question, Joe. Where did you first see or hear Frank Sinatra?
As my father would take us to school every morning, God bless him, and when we went to a different school, and he would have to drive us about 20 minutes up to the school, and he had on the radio was always Francis Albert Sinatra, a gentleman by the name of William B. Williams.
Oh yeah,
and he was the legendary radio announcer who actually gave Mr. Sinatra
the title,
the term chairman of the board.
Yeah,
that's right,
dubbed him the chairman of the board.
And I would listen. But you know what, Ray? You would dig this because you're great musically and you sing great. And I just love everything that you do, my brother, really.
Oh, you're very
and, but
kind.
I couldn't decipher between Vic Damone, Tony Bennett, or Frank Sinatra until I started listening in that car, which was a Chrysler 300 convertible, man. Robin Egg Blue with an engine that you couldn't make today, you know? And I would listen to the, to that's where I got hip to Mr. S, was with my dad like that. And then my father goes, when I wanted to go into entertainment, he said, you want to be like anybody, use Frank Sinatra as your role model. I'm in Bluefield. When we went to Mario's barbershop, you know, we'd go in Bluefield, we'd go, and then you'd walk in, and there were two pictures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra, and Frank Sinatra was above the Pope in Bluefield, you know what I mean? So it was like, no disrespect.
That was like my family, too. Yeah, they always had, Sinatra always had the pride of place. Look, well, here's what amazes me, Joe. You were hesitant to do Frank Sinatra on Saturday Night Live. Why?
Oh, please. It was because I'm Italian, and he's Italian, and it's respect.
What, you thought he was going to come visit you? What did you think?
No. You know what people say, you know? It's like, you know, Mr. Sinatra does not like what you're doing on TV. It wasn't anything like, wasn't like that, man. It wasn't like that. No, but it was like, I started doing the Frank Sinatra impression at improvisation. You would love this, too. Yeah. This is a bit you could do tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's like where I would say, lady is a tramp, but I wouldn't end the song. That's why the lady. And I kept going to annoy the crowd. Why the lady? Hey, that lady. It was very Andy Kaufman-esque.
You would milk
the Andy.
Yeah. Which was kind of true,
then,
Joe.
So that, yeah, you know what I mean. Yes. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
So now I did it on SNL and I did the impression at the audition, and I remember I said I'd love Mr. Sinatra. He says the word you, and I sang, I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you.
Come on, baby, it's time. It's time for you.
So they liked it. I go on and I do the impression. I wrote him a letter. I wrote Mr. Sinatra a letter through Mickey Rudin, his attorney at the time. Mm-hmm. This is not to be disrespectful. If it bothers you in any way, Mr. S, my father told me you're the number one Italian-American. I will cease and desist, you know? And you know what? I didn't hear anything. And I do it again. We do it again. And then, sure enough, I get an invitation in the mail, all gold embossed, from the Friars Club. Mm. And it's an invitation to the roast of Dean Martin. Roast of Dean Martin. Who's the master of ceremonies? Francis Albert Sinatra. He's the man. And that's where he gave me the okay.
And that's when you first met him?
Yes. Yeah, it was Cavett made the introduction, because I went in and I do this bit on stage, but there was Sammy Davis Jr., you know, and Sammy was, what a sweetheart, Samuel. Mm-hmm. Hey, man. Yeah, man. And you never knew where Sammy was looking because of his eye. Yeah. Hey, man. It was like that. You know, but a sweetheart of a guy. And then Dean Martin, I saw there was, and I'm 28. I wasn't even 30 years old. And I'm among my hero. Angie Dickinson was there. Shirley MacLaine. Milton Berle. It was really great. So Cavett grabs me, and Dick's a great guy. Cavett's a great guy. He goes, hey, come here, Joe. I want to take you someplace. So he walks me all the way to the back of the room, a little private place. And then I had my head down. And as I tell the story, this is the way it happened. And I looked up, and there was Frank Sinatra right before me, as close as the camera is now, that close. And you look into the baby blues of Francis Albert Sinatra. He looks right down into your soul, man. I tell you what, you could feel the energy of this man. He was one of a kind. Mm-hmm. And he's right there. And Cavett goes, Joe Piscopo, Frank Sinatra. And I actually froze, you know, and we shook hands. And it was very nice. And I didn't know if he knew who he was. But I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. Yeah. Then later on the dais, this is the way it really happened. Yeah. I dramatized it on stage a little bit. But because, you know, you and I, we don't tell lies. You know, we go to confession if
that's
it
right.
happens.
Tell it
but,
straight,
you know,
Joe.
I'll be honest with you. So I'm on the dais. And then Frank Sinatra is down on the stage at the podium, introduces me. And when you hear the old man, Mr. S, as we affectionately refer to him as the old man, he goes, Joe Piscopo, this kid's great. He does me. He's Italian. please welcome the vice chairman of the board, Joe Piscopo. Boom, like that. Wow. I go, whoa. So I go up there. Now I do what I did at the audition to Mr. S. Mm-hmm. He's to my left, D. Martin's to my right. I'm a kid, man. And Mr. S is right there, and he's got a Jack Daniels in his hand, and he's got a cigarette in the other, going, right? And now he's watching me like this, right? He's watching me like mm-hmm. this. And I go, I don't stand a ghost of a chance, and I go, with you, like that. And he takes a beat, and he goes like this, that's pretty good. So I take the moment to say, hey, can I call you Frank? And he says, no. Like, that was great. He said, hey. I'll tell you what, biggest laugh of the night. It's like, you know, you're good kid, but don't push it. Right?
I remember, and I'm aging myself, Joe. I remember watching yeah. Solid Gold, which I never watched. I only watched it because
yes!
one time God, Frank Sinatra good, hosted Frank. And Joe Frank Pistopo. Introduced you to do an impression of him on Solid Gold.
Yeah, in makeup.
Yeah, the whole
so
routine.
It was like, so I got the call. And when Frank Sinatra called, he would call, you never asked where you're going, what am I doing. Huh. You never asked that. If you got a call from, it was Susan Reynolds who called, mm-hmm. his PR person, Mr. Sinatra yeah. would like you here, you go, got it. You just go, got it. And you're going to find, you. All you do, they send the plane tickets, they send the car. It was like a whole other era, you know? And we go, and he goes, they want you in makeup as Frank Sinatra, to Frank Sinatra. I go, you kidding me? So I bring Kevin Haney out, mm-hmm. and then I got to the studio. I'll never forget. And then I went in the studio. I said, is Mr. S here? And he goes, yeah, he's in makeup. So I said, can I say hi to him? He goes, yeah, he's in makeup. The door's closed in makeup. I go over. I'm scared out of my mind, and I knock on the door. The door opens, and there's one of my heroes, Frank Sinatra, my father's hero, and he's sitting, he's got a members-only jacket on, you know, he's got his elbow on the makeup chair. I remember he had his foot out on the footrest, and he had these really cool-looking 1980s boots on, Ray. You know what I'm saying? It was the epitome of awesome coolness. The half boots, man! And he looked, and it was Frank, he's, you know what he did? Again, what I learned from Mr. Sinatra? He jumped up. He stood up immediately as I walked in. I'm a kid. He stood up. Hey, Joe, baby, how are you? How you doing? And he said to the gal I was with, hey, is he wacky around the house? He used the word wacky, which I love. Yeah. Hey, is he wacky around the house like that? But, you know, it was respect, man. It was loyalty and respect and all the great things about the Italian-American heritage that my parents taught me, that my grandparents taught me. And there it was in the greatest entertainer for me of all time, Frank Sinatra. So, oof. And then I did him, as you saw,
yeah.
I did him to him.
It's hilarious.
And I'm alive to tell the story, my friend.
Yeah, that's right. And you survived. And I know our pal Jerry Lewis did SNL with you, and you all bonded. What did he teach you, Joe?
You know, Jerry, you are the guy. You are the guy that did the single greatest interview with Jerry Lewis. Ray, I tell you, that is credibility and that is legend, my dear friend. I'm not yeah. just patronizing
he was ready.
You.
You know, he was ready to tell the tale, Joe. I do think there's a period where people are just ready, and he was really ready then. And we did connect. It was like when you described the thing with Eddie earlier. There are people who just gel and you can't fake it. It's just there or not.
And he will see insincerity in a second, as you know.
Oh, yes.
The one thing I learned about Jerry had a sixth sense. And if he saw you were off a little bit, fact that he accepted you, it might have been Fanta soda? Is that what you brought
him? Yeah, I brought him
the Irish soda.
Good memory. Yeah. Chris, my producer, who's still my producer, it was Jerry's birthday. I said, what am I going to get him for his birthday? So I knew he drank that awful orange Fanta, sickly sweet, give me a diabetic cold. Soda. So I went down to the whatever it was, the Giant or the supermarket near his house. I got a case of Fanta soda. We put a big red ribbon around it. And I walked into the house first time I met the man. And I said, well, what do you get the man who's got everything? I said, how about this? And I dropped it in front of him. And he laughed his butt off. And that was the beginning. That was it. I was in.
And thank you for that, man, because those of us who love him and cherish him as the genius that he was, but when he came on SNL, and then, and this was how it happened, because he knew what a big fan I was, I guess, because I got word from security when he was going to host, and he was first coming up to the 17th floor at SNL, and they said, Jerry's on the way up. I got the lead from security, And so I started down the hallway to get to the elevator. I hear the elevator door open. I hear the great Jerry Lewis talking. And I go, Jerry! Jerry! Why? I don't know. It's what came out. Jerry! What do I hear at the elevator around the corner? Joe! Joe! Oh, and we hugged, and it was a love affair. And here's one of your cinematic icons, you know, because don't forget, I'm a kid, I'm 9 years old, whatever I am, watching The Nutty Professor, and here he is in person. Could not have been more gracious. And me and Eddie and the whole cast, we had the time of our life, one of our greatest guests ever.
See, if you're going to do an impression, you know the best one, like when I was nine, you know why? I love to watch TV a lot. When Gilligan's Island was on, I love that.
I don't do that's the section of the character, Jerry. I don't do that.
Oh, you only do the straight?
The straight, Jerry, yes.
I was stunned reading the book that you were going to do The Nutty Professor, and he was going to direct.
Yeah.
And then Eddie ends up doing it.
Yep.
When I was young and used to watch Gilligan on the side, the habit, don't.
Yeah, is that the funniest thing? And I remember when we were in the room up on the 17th floor, and we used to get the 35 millimeter, and they would play the movies for us, like before, if a guest was coming in, they would, a guest host, we'd say, so we're watching Nutty Professor, and I said, Eddie, this is genius, what you're seeing right now. I'm telling Eddie this as a kid. And then Jerry says to me afterwards, Joe, we should do The Nutty Professor. You're going to love when I direct. We went out to Warner Brothers with Mark Berman. It became priority one project. And I was in my glory. I'm going to do Nutty Professor. Jerry, you know, the younger guy, however it was. And then something happened where Jerry couldn't direct. Jerry wanted to direct. Jerry wasn't happy about it. And there went the project. And my heart was broken. The only solace I had was it went to Eddie, because Eddie and Jerry were very close as well. Mm. And it had to be done. But you know what? Between you and I, with due respect to everybody, that original Jerry Lewis Nutty Professor film, as you know, Raymond,
yeah,
it's Chaplin, man. It's Chaplin.
It's untouched.
You know, genius. Absolute genius.
Yeah.
Right?
Tell me, there's something, there's a serious part of the book I want to get into, and you talk about, candidly, about your cancer scare. And was it thyroid cancer?
Yeah. And thyroid cancer, yeah.
How did that, I know that led to your bodybuilding, which, you know, became kind of a brand for Joe Piscopo for a while, but how did it deepen your faith?
You know, great question, because I think when I was in high school and I almost didn't graduate high school, and then I did, I somehow, my father helped out and I graduated and I made it on to college, and I went to church. Everybody was going to parties at graduation, and I went to Notre Dame Parish in North Caldwell, got on my knees and to give thanks. But as I went on, I seemed to have lost the faith. You hear it a lot. I went to college. I was still there. But by the time Saturday Night Live, I kind of lost my faith. Hmm. So then when I was diagnosed through my brother-in-law, Dr. Haraldson, rest his soul, he was great. He found something. He said, you got something in your throat. We went and had the biopsy, and they said it could be cancer in your thyroid. And now I'm doing Saturday Night Live. Everything's happening just the way it's supposed to happen. You're starting to make it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And now what? You know what I did? To your point, Ray, I got kind of angry. You know, you get angry at God. Why is this happening? Because everything else is going so well. And then we went in. The way it happened, they took the biopsy. They said, it may be something. You got to go into surgery. I do the Saturday Night Live episode with Eddie doing Muhammad Ali, Billy Murray hosted. Remember like yesterday? Yeah. Got up the next morning, did a hit on NBC with Bryant Gumbel on NFL Today. Went right into the hospital. They cut me the next day. They took it out, took half the thyroid out, and they said, you're fine, you're great. Then I have a friend, Dr. Rock Positano. This is wild. Don't forget, I'm fine. You know what I said? I didn't say, thank you, God. I went, of course I'm fine. Uh-huh. You know, what am I, 31 years old? I got this. I don't need it. You get cocky like that. Mm. Then my friend, Dr. Rock, says, send the tumor down to NYU. They do they cut into the tumor. Remember, you know, Paul Sorvino and Goodfellas with the garlic, you know, like that. That's the way I think. That's what I picture my, you know. Well, they found, I could joke about it now, but they found a medullary carcinoma. Ooh. It was encapsulated. That's a very aggressive form of cancer. Mm. So I went, what? So I got upset, and I really pulled away from my religion then, thinking, rather than saying, this is, you moron, this is a warning sign. You're doing something wrong. Take it as a sign. And I took it as an offense, and I just lost the faith. And it took me a good 10 years after that to understand what I think God was trying to tell me, Ray. Hmm. So in the long run, my faith is unwavering and unapologetic. Yeah. You can't, and I love when I talk to you and you talk to like-minded people who understand the presence of God, the strength of the saints as a Catholic, you know. But back then I missed it, man. I missed it. But, wow. But by the grace of God, they gave me a curate in 10 years after that, you know. And then I started to see, and my faith really strengthened after
that. Well, goodness knows, you've made up for lost time, Joe Piscopo. On your radio show, you constantly talk about faith, and you cover issues of faith that, frankly, remain uncovered in many other parts of not only radio, but the media at large.
Yeah.
We could go on all day, and we will do this again, I hope, in person. But, Joe, I can't thank you enough for being here. And I have to say, Joe, people should listen to your radio show and your incredible Sundays with Sinatra that are, you know, must listen in the Arroyo House.
I love you, man. I love you. I love you being strong enough to stand up for what you believe in.
Thank you.
God bless you indeed, Ray Arroyo.
Thank
and
you,
Godspeed,
my friend.
Honored to be with you.
Thank you. Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer by Joe Piscopo is available at bookstores everywhere and online. She's a physician, retired Army colonel, superior of the Little Workers of the Sacred Heart, and a tireless defender of life. She's also the subject of a brand new book, Sister, Soldier, Surgeon, The Life and Courage of Sister Deirdre Byrne. Please welcome to the program Sister Deirdre Byrne and Dr. Lisa Marie Corazon. Thank you both for being here. Sister Dee Dee, I want to thank you first. And this book really begins in your childhood and growing up in a large family. Your father was a physician. Your mom's a homemaker. You have seven siblings, including your brother Bill, who's now the Bishop of Springfield.
Mm-hmm.
What were the lessons you learned growing up in that household? And how did they shape your receptiveness to the multiple callings that lay ahead for you?
Well, I think, first of all, my parents were wonderful leaders. My father was the spiritual guide. I think that's really important. So the family is a home of vocations. I had five brothers and I have two sisters, and we just, you learn how to stand in line to wait for the bathroom and things like that. So I think bigger is best for families, I think.
Hmm. Tell me, how did it mark your personality? I mean, obviously, in big families, you learn cooperation. You learn, as you said, to wait your turn. Did it mark you in any other ways?
I don't know. I think I was born with a dislocated hip. My mother diagnosed the condition. And I remember I had a body cast for a year and a half, and my older siblings would drag me across the floor, step on me to get something high on a shelf. And I always joke around and say that, you know, I said, I learned that sometimes being stepped on is really just lifting your others up. So you learn to give and take and to not be the center of attention. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't watch TV that much. We had each other, and we were all big in sports. We weren't big in academics, so we were all really good in some sport event. And I don't know, I guess like many families, but the most important, I would say, is that both my mother and father were daily mass goers. They went to mass every day. My father was a thoracic surgeon, but he went to the 6:45 mass every day. He wouldn't miss mass. He would crawl on all fours before he'd, you know, miss communion. And my mom would, when we were all at school, she'd go to the 9 o'clock here in McLean, Virginia.
Uh-huh. Let's talk for a moment about your multiple vocations. I mean, you attend Georgetown Medical School, as the book says, first. Then you join the U.S. Army while you're still in med school to help pay for the education. How did becoming a doctor lead to your religious vocation?
Well, quite honestly, I think my religious vocation came first, and that was in utero. When, my mother always said my vocation started in utero. So I was always drawn to religious sisters, drawn to missionary work. My father was close friends with and studied with Sister Frederick Needfield, who was a medical mission sister. I met her when I was in high school. I also learned about Mother Teresa of Calcutta during that time. And she, what she did really resonated with me. It was something that I wanted to do when I grew up. I haven't grown up yet, but something I wanted to do. And so that was really important. So vocation first, nurturing it. My father was a doctor. I have a couple siblings that are doctors. And so I just followed in that realm. And then I heard there was a scholarship program with the Army, and it sounded great because my dad at that time had five of us either in college or grad school. So it was really something that would help us. And although he said, you know, I've saved the money, but I said I wanted to do something that could help them in that regard, and I never regretted it. It was bittersweet, but it was a so that was as a first-year med student, and that's a health professional scholarship program. It's still going on today.
Sister, in late 2001, you received news that really redirected your religious life. Cardinal Hickey, the longtime Archbishop of Washington, D.C., resigned, and his successor was Theodore McCarrick. Now, Hickey had intended to give you an old convent, but there was a hitch. What happened there, and where did trust in God's will take you?
Well, I always say, Hickey gaveth, McCarrick tooketh away.
He did that for a lot of people.
You know, during that time, I was at the point now. I'd finished my certification surgery. I was a board-certified family medicine surgery, basically ready for the Lord to use me in any way He wanted to. And I had emptied myself, basically, of all my free will and design. So anything that happened was, to me, not surprising, and I was okay with it. And it was during that time, too, that I met the Little Workers of the Sacred Hearts. Father Robert Falabella, who just recently died, was the guide that brought me and introduced me to my now superior, Sister Licia, who's now gone to heaven. And with emptying myself to my own will, the Lord could then fill me with what He wanted. And it was very beautiful in one way. So because Cardinal Hickey gave me a convent, he was even willing to follow me with, you know, to guide me. He was my guide. And I remember Sister Priscilla, our Mother Teresa's Secretary General, she and I were friends. She said, I've never seen a cardinal be so receptive to anyone. This must be God's will. But then when McCarrick took it away, it was more of God's seeing how much of a faithful steward I would be for him, I think.
Well, sometimes you have to be tried. You know, he tests those vocations and, you know, and your trust in him, which is, you know, the way I read it when I, when I was reading the story.
Right.
Sister, over the years, you ministered at Ground Zero on September 11th. You, as you mentioned a moment ago, you served St. Mother Teresa's. You were her personal physician. And you deployed as a surgeon to Afghanistan for Operation Enduring Freedom.
Yeah.
Give me a sense. I mean, you still travel regularly to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan to give medical aid to the victims of the war there. Throughout all of this, you continue to evangelize. How does God speak to you and direct you to as to where to go and what to do, what to spend your time doing?
I've learned in my many, many years of life now to understand that internal stirring in my own heart. Our community spends a lot of time in prayer. We, in our little house here in D.C., we have adoration two or three times a day. And I couldn't do anything without the Eucharist and adoration. And our founder said it's before the Most Blessed Sacrament that I found the love of Jesus and the power of that love. And that's really held true for me through my life. And so I think you just have to trust that hunch that's within your heart to be able to speak out, speak strongly, and know that, you know, you're here for Him, not for anyone else. So to not be afraid, as John Paul II said, be not afraid.
Lisa, how did you come to know Sister Dee Dee, and what inspired you to want to put pen to paper and capture her story now?
Thank you, Raymond. I first met Sister, like most folks, after the 2020 RNC, and I was so excited to see somebody in habit raise her rosary for the whole nation to see and proclaim that she was not just pro-life, but pro-eternal life. I literally cheered in my living room, as did many people of faith. I called her cold, and I just expressed my gratitude for the exemplary courage that this woman showed. I was so excited. I asked for permission to meet her, and when I went to ask for permission to write the book, her response was, "You must be writing a comic book." And then she begged me, could I please wait until she's dead? I assured her, Sister, we can't wait until you're dead. Our children and grandchildren need you now more than ever. We need her to be our voice.
Sister Dee Dee, I know you fairly well. Give me a sense of what your reaction was when you heard this. I mean, I remember when I went to Mother Angelica and asked her if I could write her biography, she was a little cold to it at first and then said, okay, let me pray about it. Let's start and see what happens. That's what she said. But I think she almost said that to try to get me to go away. What did you think when Lisa came to you with this idea?
You know, I was trying my best to discourage her. But nothing would discourage her. I mean, every time we got one bad news, you know, because President Trump had endorsed the book, God bless him, a lot of people were running away. And she persevered. She cut out a couple chapters and threw in new chapters. And so I really admire that, but I wish it wasn't me. I wish I wasn't the topic. But if it's going to be for the glory of God and for... You know, maybe vocations, young ladies will see that you can be not only a religious sister, but you can do things through with the gifts that God has given you. So, and I get to talk to you, Raymond, which is wonderful.
Well, that's right. See, another fringe benefit, but you could talk to me before there was a book, and I'm sure you'll talk to me after. So, though, look, you've been no stranger to public scrutiny, despite your desire to avoid it. When the COVID pandemic began, there was great uncertainty. There were curfews and church closures. And in August of 2020, as Lisa mentioned, you spoke at the RNC, striking a chord with millions of people. You said, I'm not just pro-life, but pro-eternal life. And your words galvanized the pro-life movement at that time. In the book, Dr. Corazon writes, she calls it your Esther moment. And you took a lot of heat for speaking and supporting President Trump at the time. Your thoughts on the recent election that we saw? This historic second term secured by President-elect Trump and his pro-life record compared to the alternative?
Well, I'm grateful to God that he was elected, because I don't know what would happen to our country if he wasn't in the held. And I think J.D. Vance is wonderful, too. They're going to make a great dynamic duo. I do pray that I can have an opportunity to talk to him about the RU-486 and the in vitro fertilization issue. But he's very strong in the life is not only just the unborn, but it's you know, the dignity of a human person, young children, you know, the fighting of the issue of men being in female sports, the transgender issue in the military, which I think has ruin the military, and we need to get back to where we were. So, you know, our dear President Trump is going to correct all those things. The Mexico law, where our tax money is going to pay for contraception, things like that, he's going to undo all that. And I pray that he's going to help get a lot of these unfair, these young J6ers who are thrown in prison that are still there, for our pro-lifers, Joan Bell, you know, Will Goodman, many who have been in prison for a year and a half. Praying at an abortion clinic, a third trimester abortion clinic in D.C., where he's still killing babies in the third trimester. So he's going to do a lot of wonderful things. So I just hope that if he's listening to this, that he lets me have 5 minutes with him on the abortion pill, because we have reversed, we're 88% successful in our little convent of bringing life, helping to our little babies from being aborted from the abortion pill to surviving. It's very successful.
Sister Dee Dee, you've ministered to hundreds and hundreds, thousands probably of people. But during the COVID pandemic, you used a medicinal protocol that was very effective. You kept people out of the hospital, prevented further injuries, saved lives. But these were strategies that were shunned by the mainstream medical establishment. You eventually took the D.C. government to court, and you won an exemption from the vaccine mandate. What did that experience teach you, sister? Did it teach you anything?
Well, no. I'm always learning. First of all, shout out to the Thomas More lawyers for and Chris Farrar for helping me win that case, and you and Laura Ingraham bringing it out to the open. I just learned that we shouldn't be afraid when it comes to truth, speaking the truth with love. You know, I felt that that vaccine was something was not good for me, in the sense that I didn't want to take something that was either tested by or made by aborted fetal tissue. That was one thing. I was very careful if I was near someone who was elderly or sick. I treated my mother, who's now 101, and Sister Alicia, who was 89 at the time. And we successfully treated everyone, elderly, hundreds and hundreds of people with this therapy. So I learned to trust in God. Each step, it's always a greater level of trust. And to know that with truth and love, we can fight and stand strong. As a result of winning, all the healthcare practitioners in Washington, D.C. had their religious exemption accepted. And I would walk in the hospital and people would come up to me that I didn't even know, thanking me for fighting. Because I guess I was the tip of the arrow of that fight, and they thought if I went down, the rest can go down. But, I didn't have anything to lose.
You prevailed.
Yeah, I prevailed. I didn't have anything to lose, really, to fight this issue. I don't have a family, so if they wanted to strip me away of my medical license, it would be really a harm to all the poor that we take care of in our city through our convent. But so.
Well, Sister Dee Dee, at the end of the book, you and Lisa offer 10 prescriptions, moral prescriptions, if you will, for an ailing nation. I'm going to take a few of these. Holy Mass, of course, Eucharistic adoration, frequent confession, and the rosary really lead the list. Any other prescriptions that you would share with the audience that you think are crucial at this moment?
Okay. Well, I think, again, with that solid basis of prayer, everything else will follow forward. Making family number one, standing strong, being a faithful husband or a faithful wife. Your family is the most important, so you have to be strong to support them, and don't be afraid to stand strong to support them. And that includes with their education and things like that, to be family first, and everything else will follow.
Well, something you said earlier, truth, standing and speaking the truth, which is harder and harder today, and that commitment to go where it leads you. And those are hard things, particularly when you're under attack, when no one is in your corner. And I love that you exemplified you don't only give lip service to those principles, you live them. Dr. Corazon, I'm going to give you the last word here. Look, when I was doing Mother Angelica's biography, there were things I never imagined there that I discovered. I didn't know she dated anybody in Canton, Ohio, but there were a lot of other controversies with bishops and things that were happening privately. Give me the number one surprise, the biggest surprise that you unearthed as you started to write this book.
I love the way Sister lives her faith, came out of her upper room, which in that case for Sister was her chapel, and permeated culture with beauty, truth, and goodness. So for me, it really, the whole book, her whole life exemplifies not only her threefold calling as a sister soldier and surgeon, but really the way she loves so beautifully. That is the call of this book, to follow Sister from the upper room, from beyond prayer, and to emerge into taking our faith into the public square, to permeate it with beauty, truth, and goodness. Nobody did that as beautifully as she did that.
Sister, I'll give you the last word. Any final messages as we wrap up Advent, move toward Christmas, for the audience, what family should keep in mind?
Well, right now, Jesus, as my brother will say, Jesus, don't make Jesus a premature infant. So focus on his Advent more. And celebrate his birth on December 25th. But before that, let's focus on the hope that comes with Advent.
Sister Dee Dee, Dr. Corazon, thank you for being here. Sister Soldier Surgeon, The Life and Courage of Sister Deirdre Byrne by Dr. Lisa Marie Corazon is available at bookstores everywhere, including the EWTN catalog. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. I know.